I'm Josh Cohen.
I'm Alex Edwards.
I'm Corey Gergen.
And I'm Eric Lewis.
And this is Technically Pop.
So we're recording today pretty hot off of the finale of the first and maybe only, I don't know if this there's word on this, season of WandaVision, the first Disney Plus television show set in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. In part due to the coronavirus pandemic, this is the first new MCU content that we've seen since Spider-Man Far From Home, which premiered in 2019, July 2nd, 2019. It's impossible to know anything specific about the ratings of streaming television shows, but by most metrics, this seems to have been a success. People have been watching it and talking about it online. On the last nine Fridays, social media has been full of people begging each other not to spoil the show for each other. And this comes after the successful second season of The Mandalorian, which is set in the Star Wars universe. So today we're going to talk about our thoughts about both of these shows and about what their success means for the future of these franchises, for Disney, for their competitors, and for the future of moviegoing. Fair warning, as always, we will probably spoil both of these shows. So if you haven't watched them and don't want to be spoiled, maybe wait and come back later. Just to get started, I thought we could go around and talk about our personal histories with these franchises, and our general thoughts about these two shows. Josh, would you like to start?
Sure. So I'm a huge fan of all this stuff, Star Wars especially, also Marvel, pretty much anything comics related I'm pretty into. I really, really, really liked both of these shows. I liked The Mandalorian Season 2 a bit more than WandaVision, but I think they're both really good, really interesting. I've read a lot of the kind of background inspiration for WandaVision, so there's a couple comics in particular that I wanted to just mention if people haven't read. If you liked WandaVision, you should read Tom King's Vision run, in which Vision creates an AI family and moves to the suburbs, and all sorts of things predictably don't go according to plan. And then there's another kind of event from a while ago called House of M, which is where the idea of Wanda creating a perfect world through her powers and mind control comes from. So those two comics are really interesting. But I thought both shows were great. They have some, you know, some quirks and some flaws, of course, as I'm sure we'll get into. But I am generally in favor of more of this content, so it seems like I'm getting my wish.
you definitely are. Alex, how about you?
I've been a Marvel fan for decades now. I was always the person who was skeptical of DC and really in favor of Marvel comics, and was reading comics sort of right after I think House of M happened, because that was the whole, like, there was a long period of time where all of the crossover events were like Brian Michael Bendis's Brain Children. And I came to reading like Marvel monthlies pretty much right after that. Have seen almost all of the, wait, have I seen them all? Oh God. Now I can't remember. Maybe I've seen all the Marvel Cinematic Universe films that have come out. And I'm a more sort of, recent or hesitant Star Wars fan. But I also liked Mando Season 2 much more, than I liked WandaVision. Although I thought WandaVision did a lot of interesting things. But I'm with Josh. Like, I think that this style of long form storytelling within these, really established universes is a good direction for these brands to go. And so I'm also like in favor of these TV shows.
Excellent. Eric, how about you? Are you going to give us some conflict?
I think I will. Yeah. So in terms of background, I have lived and breathed Star Wars for about as long as I can remember. Like, I can't remember a time when I had not seen Star Wars. My earliest cinematic memories are being afraid of Darth Vader during the re-release of Return of the Jedi. And I love everything related to Star Wars. Like, for a few years, like recently, the recurrent gift that people would give me at holidays was like, oh, here's the Star Wars Lego set. I've played a ton of the video games. I've read some of the books, although I'm kind of limited in my book outreach. And overall I have enjoyed the Disney movies, although The Rise of Skywalker is one of the worst things that has ever happened to me. I hate that movie. I don't consider it the worst movie. No argument here.
Yeah. Absolute disaster.
You're not bringing any conflict to
this.
But
no. This is where the conflict is going to come from, I think. It's coming up. So I am not a comics person. I've never been one to read comics. My first exposure to Marvel was like catching up with the movies like 5 or 6 years late. Like, I just was lonely one day and then found them and started watching them. I was like, oh, these are entertaining. And the movies are the extent of my interaction. And then I watched WandaVision. And where I think the conflict may come in is that I, in some ways, preferred WandaVision to The Mandalorian Season 2. I feel like there is the, or I can get more into this later, but I feel like Disney-era Star Wars is pulled in two different directions that you could argue are perhaps represented by the conflict between The Last Jedi and The Rise of Skywalker. And I feel like The Mandalorian sometimes falls too far into the nostalgia direction, and it frustrates me, as opposed to telling us new stories, as opposed to like fleshing out the universe further. And I thought WandaVision did something that I found more interesting, just in how weird it was.
Yeah. So, I, as I think I said on an episode of this show last year, I, like Eric, I don't remember not knowing what Star Wars was. I was watching those movies well before I could maintain the plot of an entire movie in my head at one time. I had a period where I was reading many of the expanded universe novels, things like that. I was not as intensely involved in Marvel. I think because I had VHS recordings of all those Star Wars movies and I could pop them in over and over again. Whereas there was like a purchasing threshold to keeping up with the Marvel comic books. Where I did engage with Marvel is I was really into statistics as a kid. Like, I like would like check the box scores every morning. I don't think I even liked baseball so much as I liked thinking about like batting averages and ERAs and things like that. And so I collected, you know, baseball cards. And I also, there were, when I was a kid, you could get Marvel character trading cards.
Yeah, you could.
Yeah. And I had friends who were more into Marvel than me, and they like got me into collecting these cards, and I was really in, like, they had whatever year's version I was collecting, they had like stats on the back. They weren't really stats. It was it was like, and so like, you, like, my friends would be having a conversation about like whatever was happening in like the Spider-Man comic run at that moment, and I would chime in with very helpful information like, well, the Green Goblin is much smarter than Peter Parker because he has a 7 in intelligence. So that was how I helped those conversations.
You couldn't just Google it back in those days. You had to actually do the analog. You had to look through your trading cards and look at their stats. That's right.
Yeah. So that was always my connection to Marvel, was like collecting those cards a little bit. I saw some of the movies in their first run. Like, I was kind of like a check the reviews person. I wasn't like a snob about it, but I didn't, you know, I went to see some of them. I didn't see some of them. And then actually during the pandemic, Katie and I have gone back and we have now rewatched them all in order. This was, I think, Alex, you told me recently that you watched all of Kurosawa's films. I have watched all of the MCU. So
I'm actually not up to all of Kurosawa's films yet. I still have some to go. But I did rewatch all the Marvel movies in advance of Infinity War.
Excellent. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. And yeah, I think I liked both of these shows. I have reservations about both of these shows. And we can get into this. I really didn't like the last episode of WandaVision.
Me either. Oh my God.
But I'm not the kind of person who lets a bad ending like I enjoyed the ride to the last episode, but I really did not like the last episode. And I think Eric, you and I share some similar concerns about Mando and sort of what it means about where they're going with it. Do we want to talk about one of these shows first or the other? What do you all want to talk about?
I think Eric's point is a good one, maybe just to help us frame the discussion. So there's this idea of both of these shows and Disney Plus in general and Disney as a larger entity are trying to do two things. They're trying to grow their fan base and they're trying to retain their older fan base, right? So they're trying to make shows that new people unfamiliar with Star Wars and the MCU will find compelling. And then they're trying to make shows that speak to our desire for nostalgia or reliving older stories or having unanswered questions about these universes answered or whatever the case may be, right? So I think one way to think about it is how successful were each of these shows at those different tasks? And kind of to Eric's point, are those tasks too different that it's putting a strain on the storytelling themselves?
I think I actually might want to quibble a little bit with at least those dual missions for WandaVision, because I'm not sure that you could watch WandaVision as a quote unquote new Marvel fan and have any fucking idea what's happening. It is so directly coming out of specifically the Avengers films themselves, like the Avengers films proper.
That's true. It's so tied to her appearances in the movies. However, it is basically an origin story that we never really got on screen. And I do think some people are watching it new, people who are more into the like TV history side of it, the sitcoms and kind of like the weird, like the Truman Show side and like the Dick Van Dyke Show side. I think you actually can watch it because it fills in those gaps for you. You eventually find out, spoiler alert, this guy Vision died, right? The Kat Dennings character fills it in she killed you and then Thanos went back in time and killed you again and she had to watch. And it gives us that backstory of like with the scepter and the Mind Stone and Sokovia and the experiments with Hydra. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's very clear that this degenerates very quickly into in-universe jargon, so I'm sorry about that. But all that to say is they actually, by the end of the show, they give us like a second origin story of a character that's kind of like better fleshed out than it was in Age of Ultron, which is the first Marvel movie she appears in. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. I don't know. I would love to find someone who's never seen a Marvel movie but has seen WandaVision and, like, ask them how they felt about it. Because I hear what you're saying, but I also think that when they do this in the comic books, and it's that thing where someone will throw off a line, like the Kat Dennings line about, like, well, she killed you and then went back in time and then blah, blah, blah. And then there will be a little, like, asterisk, and then they'll say, like, read New Avengers, issue 674. And that shit just always would piss me off because, you know, like, even now it's not that easy to just go track down New Avengers issue 674 or what the fuck ever, right? So I think sometimes that can feel like this is the bone they're throwing to quote unquote new audience members. But again, like, yeah. it's hard to know how successful that would be.
So I will say I do have an example of this. We can't ask her, but Emily Nussbaum, TV critic mm-hmm. and writer for The New Yorker, she said on Twitter, this is from February 27th, I'm not an MCU fan. I haven't watched any of the movies. Neither have most of the people I know who are into the show. And she was talking in the context of one thing I love about WandaVision is that it's not just a celebration of TV. It's a celebration of formula. Its argument is that the thing that people use to put the medium down is a central part of the appeal. And there's some other responses to her and kind of goes back and forth. But she's basically saying that she doesn't know the character from the comics. She doesn't know the Marvel background. So I think people who are into that side of it, like the sitcom stuff and the kind of TV history stuff, I think they came to it with a lot of enthusiasm. Although maybe to be fair, if you also don't know anything about Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie and you don't know anything about Marvel, then yeah, maybe you're not going to find this show compelling.
Yeah. I would say to me, those moments that gestured out to the character's larger histories didn't seem like a bone that was thrown so much as like a trail of breadcrumbs. I felt like they were serving the same purpose as those footnotes in the comic strips where, you know, maybe you don't quite know what Kat Dennings' character is talking about here, but if you wanted to learn more, you could find out right here on Disney Plus, which is available to you for $15.99 a month or whatever, you know, whatever automatically is deposited, you know, from my account into Disney Plus each month. And, you know, like starting around episode 5 or 6, our Disney Plus started auto-suggesting Age of Ultron, which is the film where a lot of this stuff happened. It's also, and I don't want to start a debate, it's not one of the more well-liked movies in the universe.
Oh,
is that fair to say?
It's straight up the worst. It's straight up the worst film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I think it's quite bad. I don't like it. And a lot of people don't like it. And I think part of the reason why they would point back to that movie is that that's where this character originated. This is where, like, the initial trauma of this character, you know, starts to come clear.
Both of them, because it's also where Vision comes from.
Right, correct, thank you. I forgot that because so many things happen in that movie. But anyway, right, yeah, so it is both of these characters' origin point. It's where her brother dies, right, which is kind of one of the, like, primal sources of trauma for her in the series. But also, it's like, one of the less, like, profitable properties within this larger franchise, right? So why not direct people to it, right? Why not try to cultivate, like, from Disney's perspective, right? Like, let's give people a reason to watch this movie that no one wants to watch.
Right. But the problem, though, is that then they're going to watch the movie and they're going to be like, I didn't like that. I'm not sure about this Marvel thing. I wasn't into that at all.
But maybe they will, because they will bring this, like, fuller consideration of these characters into it, right? And then, like, I'm just going to be honest with you all. I must have not had Vision's trading card when I was – I didn't understand who Vision was until, like, last year.
He's pretty obscure. Yeah,
it's actually not that complicated, but the movie didn't do a great job of explaining where he came from.
Well, he came from Ultron.
Right. He came from Ultron and also the Mind Stone and also
Jarvis.
Bruce Banner's brilliance, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's that Age of Ultron is truly garbage. It's a garbage piece of cinema. It hardly works as a film. It begins, we don't have to continue on this track, but I love trashing Age of Ultron. It begins in media res in such a way that you feel like you've missed the first reel of the film, as though films are still split up onto reels. It's not exciting in any way with that opening. It's just confusing. It's marred by actors who are clearly uncomfortable on set and are not along for the ride of what the director's vision is. No pun intended.
you You sound like a Marvel Cinematic Universe villain when you pun like that.
That's my goal. Yeah, I want to be the Agatha Harkness of the real world. I will say one thing I thought was interesting and frustrating about WandaVision for me, and maybe this can get us into more sort of on-the-ground discussion of the show. I was very excited when they announced who was cast in the film or in the show go along with Wanda and Vision, right? So bringing back Randall Park from the Ant-Man movies, bringing back Kat Dennings from the Thor movies, I don't think it had been announced at the time, but I was very excited when I saw Emma Caulfield in the show, and Catherine Hahn. And to me, those were all people who, well, not Emma Caulfield as much, but Randall Park, Kat Dennings, and Catherine Hahn were all people who had the utmost, like, sitcom chops, you know? And so I really thought we were going to, like, that they would leverage all of that experience. And they did with Catherine Hahn, and I think she gives an absolutely stellar performance. And I also have a really, like, galaxy brain take on, like, the second to last episode, I think. I was disappointed to see that Kat Dennings and was only in the sitcom world for, like, a second, and by the time she was there, it wasn't even very sitcom-y anymore.
She does like a little Curb Your Enthusiasm-y, like, runabout, but that's about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So she really didn't get to leverage that Two Broke Girls experience. It would have been the only thing Two Broke Girls was good for.
So, that's a really good point. And again, this gets to Eric's question. Are these missions, is the show ultimately, are the flaws in the show due to the fact that it's trying to be both an MCU miniseries, which, I mean, we could talk about the finale, the big fight scenes, the very typical action sequences.
The way that white supremacy Vision just disappears and never is seen again with no explanation. I thought I had, like, blacked out.
No.
He'll be seen again.
It was fully explained, Alex. He both is the ship of Theseus and is not the ship of Theseus. And therefore, he must go.
He's got to go reflect.
I think what happened is that as soon as they said that, I started thinking about Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts, and then I started thinking about whether or not Wanda and Vision's, like, family story was inherently queer, Maggie Nelson writing about the Argonauts and the ship of Theseus and ass fucking, and I think I just, like, completely blacked out and missed when they explained to me where White Vision was going.
Yeah, to be fair, he takes a quick exit. There's clearly too much going on in that finale, and we could talk more about that. I don't think any of us love that episode. But just to say, this show has this really cool concept of recapitulating the history of sitcoms in American television. And as the episodes progress, of course, we enter more fully into the MCU world of superheroes and technology and AI and more predictable villains, and we move away from that more weird experimental stuff where it's like, this is just an episode. This is just an homage to the Dick Van Dyke Show. You know, this is just an homage to the Brady Bunch with these characters and fleshing out some of these themes. So I think if there's a criticism to be made is that maybe the balance, they were trying to balance those two things, right? They wanted both of those audiences, people who would think the concept was cool, and then people who were just MCU fans, and they wanted to see Wanda use her powers, and Vision use his powers, and everybody use their powers.
So my galaxy brain take is that I think it's the second to last episode, the one where we get Agatha's backstory. When it's revealed that Catherine Hahn is not Agnes, but she's Agatha Harkness, which is the character from the comics.
It's revealed at the end of this third to last episode, and then that she is, like the Agatha All Along song is the end of episode 6, and then episode 7 starts with her full backstory, I think.
Is that 7 or 8? It doesn't matter.
8.
So the penultimate. So the penultimate episode is the one that begins, and here we go. We have had this sort of decade by decade, right, like stylistically in terms of color palette, in terms of set, in terms of camera movement. It has all been stylistically moving us through the decades with these touchstones of like whatever the kind of archetypical or sitcom of that decade was, the Dick Van Dyke Show. I don't know what the 50s would have been, or the 60s, excuse me, but
Bewitched.
Yes. Yes.
I think we've, I think we've inverted those, but those were, I think, the first two.
Dick Van Dyke was definitely number one.
Was it?
Okay. Yeah. Cause that's the live in front of a studio audience one, which they did film live in front of a studio audience. Regardless. Yes. We go through the Brady Bunch. We go through then Modern Family is like the most, recent one.
You've that got they full, get up full to. House in there, like in the right. 90s. Yep.
Right, absolutely. Malcolm in the Middle.
Yes.
Is another one. So we go Malcolm in the Middle, we go Modern Family, and I fucking died when they did all those, like, zoom-ins and all that, like, aggressively terrible mockumentary camera movement that Modern Family does.
Yes, totally.
Yes.
So hilarious. And then that episode, the penultimate episode, begins and we are in a hour-long CW drama. Supernatural CW drama. We are in Riverdale. We're in The Vampire Diaries. It is, everything about it is pitch perfect. That scene in the woods of Georgia, is where Vampire Diaries was filmed, with the bad... the old English font that tells us we're in Salem, Massachusetts, and the witches all outside doing, you know, what on set must be the most embarrassing, like, hand movements. And then they put bad CG over top of it. And I just thought that it was so brilliant to suggest that The Vampire Diaries is itself a kind of sitcom.
Yeah,
totally.
Even though it's not.
I love it so much. No, I love that take. That's really great.
There's not more to it than that. It's just.
Because the creators have been giving interviews now. One of the creators has said that the episode, there's like that midpoint episode where they do away with the sitcom stuff altogether and they just catch up on the outside. Mm-hmm. That at one point that was conceived as a CSI riff.
That's what it is. Mm. Yeah.
Well, but it was like, it was going to be more like explicitly, right? And that they decided that they wanted to focus on sitcoms. But I think your reading of that episode, I like that, that like maybe they decided that the teen supernatural drama is in fact, in some ways, a continuation of the family sitcom.
It might have been that setup was from an older sort of pitch or breaking of the further back in the process of breaking the arc of the season. And that those references somehow stayed through the revising, away from the CSI stuff. I both do see how that real world stuff is a little bit CSI-esque, but it's also straight up Thor. Like it's almost beat for beat, the original Thor film.
Yeah, just like Kat Dennings cracking jokes in front of like fake computers.
Well, right. And the like tent city set up around some sort of anomaly that some governmental agency, except now it's Sword instead of Shield, is going to like have to deal with. Yeah.
I do want to just build on that point that Alex has made to say, I think the thing that's most successful about this show is that the form fits the content. So this homage to the sitcom as kind of the central genre of American television perfectly dovetails with the main themes or ideas in the show, which are all about Wanda dealing with her grief over Vision's death. And in the show, she's created this nostalgic sitcom world, and I would argue that the sitcom is ultimately a genre about deflecting from grief, and it's one of the reasons I think it's had such staying power and is our national kind of TV genre, because the whole concept of keeping things orderly, you know, having happy endings, having recognizable character beats, she's trying to enforce this, literally enforce this on people's minds by having them play certain parts, but she's in denial about Vision's death, and she wants to create this idea of a happy family, right? So the choice of the sitcom is not incidental. It's not like, oh, we just like these shows, we want to do an homage to it. It actually fits perfectly with what the show is about, which is one woman who is struggling to overcome the loss of her husband and not knowing what to do about it, and her choice or her instinct to use her powers in this way that creates Westfield, right, as this like nostalgic town where nothing bad is happening to her, where she's safe. It's literally a bubble, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That it just works really well as a metaphor or an allegory of what we do when we are grieving in real life, right? We create bubbles. We kind of often manipulate the people around us. We force them to play certain roles. And we are just in denial. We live in a fantasy world where we're not confronting the grief. So I think that's the brilliance of the show, is that those two things fit, they align so well together.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. That was sort of my favorite aspect of the show. And there's that scene in that penultimate episode. As Agatha is like taking Wanda through these like key moments in her life to try to like, to do her evil plan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like everyone on the internet kind of went crazy over something that Vision says to her about grief, but actually the lines that jumped out to me was that the sort of in-universe explanation for why she went to sitcoms was that she and her family watched these shows to learn English, and mm-hmm. then her parents become orphaned as a result of this war. It's not worth kind of, you know, Marvel Universe struggles to represent Eastern Europe in a meaningful way, so I'm not going to get into it, but as they're choosing the show, her brother is asked, somebody says the word shenanigans, and her brother asks what that means, and they like kind of, they articulate a definition that it's like, well, it's danger, but it's not really dangerous, right? It's sort of like a fun danger.
Right. And nobody gets hurt at the end.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, nobody gets hurt. And then there is that moment with Vision before the line that became a meme where they're watching Malcolm in the Middle, right? And the dad gets like...
Oh, right.
Like the dad is doing some kind of housework and like an entire building falls on him. And Vision is concerned because Vision is a synthezoid, not a robot. And doesn't understand, and Wanda says, oh, he's fine, it's not that kind of show, like he's not hurt, it's not. And so yeah, Josh, I think that's exactly right, and that's what jumped out to me too, and what I really appreciated about the show.
That actually, I really like that reading, Josh, and it connects for me to what I felt was so successful about both seasons of The Mandalorian, which to me stands apart from the Disney sequel trilogy films of Star Wars, which I have talked about. I've talked about my opinion on this podcast before.
There's 2 hours of three of us talking about this on the Textile blog. By all means, go listen.
Go take a listen. But one of the things, you know, Mando started and we didn't know, you know, they did a really good job of keeping the secret of the child, like the existence of the child in the run up to the show actually starting. And then it became very clear that it was a kind of riff on Lone Wolf and Cub, which is this series of like six samurai films from the 1970s made in Japan about a lone samurai who has a young son, like a toddler, that he has to take with him, right? And they're fascinating films if you haven't seen them. And it's all about like sort of, you know, not only just doing this horrific violence and cutting people's limbs off and stuff in front of this child, but then also like the child himself becomes sort of part of the violence and complicit in the violence that's happening. But of course they're the heroes, so you like root for when the baby blinds the people who are attacking Lone Wolf so that he can, you know, decapitate them or whatever. And of course, also we have like all the Western references, right? Mm-hmm. And then season two, I thought did something really interesting where it sort of broadened out what its inspiration texts were, like where it was pulling from. So we had the Ahsoka episode, which is so Kurosawa-esque that mm-hmm. you could just like, I could just die over it. Beautifully shot. Mm-hmm.
Dave Filoni directed that one. Yep. The Jedi episode 5.
Yep. Yep. And of course, you know, the legacy of Kurosawa in Star Wars is right. such an important part because A New Hope is essentially the Hidden Fortress. so pulling back to that kind of original animating aesthetic impulse of the Star Wars universe. But then also, like, there's an episode of season two that's the movie Sorcerer, right? So it's this, like... Have you guys seen the movie Sorcerer? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I have not, but I want to hear this.
Oh, Jesus. It's so great. And I can't remember now who directed it. It might be Friedkin. But it is a film about a group of men who have to drive incredibly explosive explosives. Damn it, I hate when I do that. They have to drive like a truck full of explosives that could just kill them all at any moment with the slightest bump. They have to drive it through like a Latin American forest jungle. And it is just like 90 minutes of terror of like, will the truck bump on a log in the mud and then kill everyone?
I love that sequence. So much. I was thinking of Wages of Fear, which is a very similar setup, but yeah.
Yes. No, you're absolutely mm-hmm. right. And Sorcerer is absolutely like building on Wages of Fear.
It is Friedkin, and also notably came out in 77, the same year as Star Wars A New Hope.
Right. Exactly. Thank you. So for me, that underlying context of the Star Wars stuff, and again, I'm a cautious Star Wars fan. I've sort of been lately converted into being interested in Star Wars in any way. But for me, the aesthetic like underpinnings were the thing that kept me going through Mando season two that I loved so much. And also, I think Pedro Pascal is a cutie.
I am with you, Alex. I think you're right that is one of the things that The Mandalorian does so well, whereas a lot of the other recent Star Wars stuff is just riffing on other Star Wars. What yes. The Mandalorian does is riff on stuff that Star Wars originally riffed on and then riff on other things. Like, I can't think of any other Sorcerer or Wages of Fear context in relation to other Star Wars content. And there are just moments where it falls into that same, we're just going to retell Star Wars stories, or we're just going to throw random small characters back into the story in a way that shrinks the universe, like having Anakin build C-3PO in episode one, that I think falls back into that riffing on Star Wars, and that's what frustrates me. But I'm curious... I've had conversations with friends about this where I complain about this scene that annoys me so much, but the references, since they are less Star Wars nerds than I am, just go over their head and they get to enjoy it. While I'm incredibly annoyed that Amy Sedaris happens to own the same exact red astromech droid that blows up in episode 4 and leads to... Mm.
You mean you weren't pining for the triumphant return of R5-D4?
I hate R5-D4.
Well, we know he doesn't function very well because that's how R2 gets bought by Owen
he
Mars.
Has a motivator. He's trying to pull Jawas. Yeah. That scene angered me so much just because I'm like, why do we need to have the same droid be there? And it took like 10 seconds to throw that in, but it made me so angry. But that's the sort of thing, if you're less of a nerd than I am, you wouldn't even notice and it would be fine.
Yeah. See, I was going to say, like, this is the analogy for this is how annoyed I was that Dr. Darcy Lewis didn't get to do more, even though it's the first time we've seen her since Thor 2. And she has clearly, like, she went and got an entire ass PhD. and yet the WandaVision doesn't, like, that could just as well not be Darcy Lewis, right? It could just not be Kat Dennings. They didn't have to get her back because it's kind of, it doesn't really add anything. Like, they don't do anything with that.
So I think, Eric, you might be in the uncanny valley of nerddom because, like you said, people who are less nerdy than you won't even notice, but some people who are more nerdy than you are, like, cheering when they see R5 and they're so into these minute things. I think, so if you guys haven't watched the behind the scenes, the Disney Gallery docuseries about it, it's really quite interesting. But I think what you're touching on is that the parents of this show, Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni, they have this yin yang thing going on where Jon Favreau, of course, also of MCU, you know, directed the original Iron Man, huge Star Wars fan, but he's not into he doesn't know all the minutiae and the gritty details. And then Dave Filoni is a walking holocron. He's George Lucas's protege. In fact, if George Lucas had met Dave Filoni a couple years earlier, the prequel trilogy would have been so much better. They worked on the animated shows, like the animated Clone Wars and Rebels, and now he's working on The Mandalorian. So there's the two sides. Dave Filoni has all this deep, minute knowledge of how the Force works and all these bit characters, all the kind of subatomic particle level details. And Jon Favreau's like, I want to do cool stories that honor, you know, he even said, let's go back to the things that inspired George Lucas, right? Let's not go back to Star Wars as much as let's go back to Kurosawa and let's go back to these Westerns, you know, Sergio Leone, right? So they're the two sides of this coin that's giving you that balance of, like, they looked for a ton of ways to work in, like, they reconstructed Jabba's palace, right, to make it look exactly like they look, like it looked for the, just for the cutscene at the end of the episode that has Boba Fett returning to take out Bib Fortuna, right? Was anyone really wanting to see Fat Bib Fortuna? Not necessarily, but it's pretty cool, and it's a great scene that, you know, Boba Fett just strolls in and takes him out and, like, sits on that throne. So they put a huge amount of effort into some of these things that only the nerdiest among us will actually care about, but then they have other interests, right? They're not just doing that. They also have these other interests, bringing in, you know, Westerns and samurai movies. And, you know, the second episode of season 2 is basically a horror movie, right? The Peyton Reed, they're escaping the ice spiders in the cave. But just to say, these other streams of inspiration are mingling with the kind of Star Wars. We could call it nostalgia. We could call it just fandom, whatever it is. I think it has a great balance between the two, but I know other people have felt it leans too strongly one way or the other.
I think, for me, I think there's a difference, and it's something that Eric said that coheres with sort of my concern about the future of The Mandalorian and Star Wars, is that these insistent coincidences and connections, like, make the universe seem smaller. To, like, wax poetic about the first time I saw A New Hope or whatever, right? But, like, everybody talks about that cantina scene, which is just, like, in some ways just, like, a collection of costumes that happen to be near the set. But what's so great about
in
it...
In all ways.
Right, like, but anyway, there's literally a devil costume that was just, like, nearby, so there's a devil alien in the Star Wars universe, right? But what's so fun about watching that scene, right?
You mean a Deveronian.
You're right. I'm sorry. I love that it's Deveronian. That's very, like, they did half the work of coming up with a new word.
So creative.
That's fantastic. But right, it's that, like, sitting there and thinking, like, everyone in that, like, we're in this cantina because of, like, two stories that are about to converge, right? But there's, like, 1,500 other stories in that cantina, right? And, like, that's one of the things that's so cool about the universe. And I'm a little bit of a hypocrite because, you know, I may have cried when Ahsoka appeared on screen in season 2 of The Mandalorian, right? I didn't care about Bib Fortuna, but if it was Fat Salacious Crumb, I would have lost my shit.
Well, they did show the they did. Other monkey lizard on the spit or whatever, yes, getting roasted.
Yes. Yeah, Salacious Crumb species is food now after the fall of the Empire. But to make a distinction that might just be to justify my own, like, I want my nostalgia and I don't care about other nostalgia. I think there's a, like, well, so to take an example from Filoni, right? In the Clone Wars, there's this whole long story about the survival of, help me, Darth Maul. Right? Yeah. That's, like, kind of absurd, and, like, I didn't have any strong feelings about Darth Maul, but, like, over the course of a couple of episodes of the show, it's, like, this really interesting world that he inhabits, and it's this interesting take on this character, and, like, I was brought into that. I was convinced to care about this, even though I didn't care about that character before it first appeared on screen. And I think that's different from just, like, putting a droid that you recognize somewhere, or, like, having Yoda meet Chewbacca.
Yeah,
in episode three, right?
Maul is a great example. That's exactly what I mean by if Lucas had met Dave Filoni earlier, the prequels would have been better. The Maul stuff in Clone Wars and then in Rebels is great. Maybe you didn't feel attached to him, Corey, because he had, like, one line in all of episode one. All he does is do a wicked fight scene at the end, which is great. Yeah. But, like, he's not a character. He's just literally, like, this guy's evil.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know what? Actually, my favorite thing that he does in episode one is when in the fight there are those, like, energy shields that they get separated by.
Yeah.
And there's just, like, this pause in the fight. And, like, Qui-Gon meditates, and Darth Maul just, like, paces with anger. It's, like, the most characterization in the entire film. Anyway.
That's, isn't that Ray Park?
It is Ray Park, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he is, you know, an incredibly talented physical actor.
Yes.
100%.
Yeah, I think, Corey, I think you and I are on the same page, because I also loved Ahsoka coming back, and I am trying to, as you say, figure out a way to avoid charges of hypocrisy, just like, there are the references back that I love, there are the references back that I hate, and I'm not, and, I mean, Josh, earlier you were saying I was maybe in an uncanny valley of nerdiness, where it's like a higher level of nerd who enjoys the things that I hate, but personally I'm tempted to be like, no, they're wrong. They're looking for the wrong things.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Well, they should want new experiences.
Yeah. It does speak to, sort of the pitfalls of nostalgia pop culture, right? Mm. And we've talked on this show before about, like, the pitfalls of nostalgia pop culture. And when all you have is nostalgia, you don't actually really have anything. Like, that's not, nostalgia is not a story, right? Nostalgia is a feeling that a story can invoke. But if all your story can do is refer back to, the previous iteration of the story, then pretty soon we're going to feel like there was no point in seeing three whole new films. right. Except there's always a point in watching The Last Jedi, because Rian Johnson is brilliant.
100%.
Yes. Yes.
But also because what Rian Johnson does is say, what is the structure of a Star Wars story, and how can I break it so that I both give you the nostalgia, but then I also am pushing towards doing something new. And I think for me, that's what Mando does, because we would never spend this much time. We have literally never gotten to spend this much time, like, on the ground with one random non-Skywalker, non-Jedi, just person in this world, right? And to me, that long form, that chance to let the characters breathe and let the story breathe, is really satisfying and fulfilling. Whereas I felt like towards the end of WandaVision, like, I'm not sure I needed to spend all this time with Wanda. It was cool, but I'm not totally sure I needed it. But by the end, Josh, you're right. There's just so much going on in that last episode of WandaVision that you can't even keep track of all of the different sort of things that are happening. And I'll say also, I think Mandalorian feels like an exploration of a corner of the universe for its own sake, and WandaVision felt a lot like the post-credit scene that you have to watch before you understand Doctor Strange 2.
I would agree with you about that last episode. But I also, like, you invoked the name Skywalker. And Mandalorian Season 2 ends with the Skywalker showing up and saving the day.
Yeah,
I lost my mind. I was so excited.
I don't.
Number one, young Luke Skywalker, also top tier cutie.
Fair.
Number two, this is a moment maybe where I'm on the right side of the Uncanny Valley, because the way we would watch the Mando is that my partner, who is like a crazy Star Wars nerd, and I say that lovingly, he would watch it as soon as he woke up in the morning on Fridays so that he couldn't get spoiled for it. And then we would watch it again at dinner time, which is when I would see it for the first time. So he already knew what was coming. But I, in my, you know, casual Star Wars fandom, was like putting the pieces together. And I was like, wait a minute, wait a minute. And I became like that meme of like the dog with its mouth open. Like, or like a Muppet, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, and I was just so thrilled and pleased with myself that I clocked it as Luke before Luke, like, actually appeared. So I felt really rewarded in that moment as a casual fan, because I was like, haha, I put all the Easter eggs together. I know things.
Oh, it's just one X-Wing? Great.
Yeah.
Right.
So one point of comparison I would say between the two finales, I also loved it. I also loved young Luke Skywalker. I think they should do an animated Luke Skywalker and have Mark Hamill do the voice, and just whatever weird adventures he's up to in this window between Jedi and Force Awakens. I thought it was really fun. But just to kind of contrast it with the WandaVision finale. So that last episode, you know, of Mando Season 2, they're rescuing the child. It's all these characters coming together, the Mandalorians and Din and Cara Dune. And, you know, you have like these, the dark troopers, right, that are robots, and they've got to fight them. And you've got Moff Gideon with the Darksaber and Din with the Beskar spear. And, you know, so you have all this, a series of fight scenes.
And hey, don't forget about Bo-Katan, okay?
Yeah,
she's also there.
Yeah, her and her other Mando pals, right? And I mean, we're going to see a lot more Bo-Katan in the next season, presumably. But so it's a series of like really well staged fights. They're saving the child. It turns out all the Dark Troopers have come back from being flushed out the airlock, right? And that's when Luke comes and has his big heroic moment. But the emotional heart of the episode is that Din and Grogu have to say goodbye, right? Because he needs to be trained by Luke. In the WandaVision finale, I think the emotional core of that episode is the harm that Wanda has done to the townspeople. And I think the most powerful scene, other than the final scene where they're watching the bubble shrink and Wanda is allowing, you know, allowing the bubble to collapse, basically, and Vision, the Vision she's recreated, who is real but is only real because of her powers, they're saying they need to say goodbye and whatever. But there's a scene in the middle, much more interesting than the action scenes of, like, the two Visions fighting or Wanda fighting Agatha even. The scene where the townspeople are finally freed and they're turning on Wanda and they're mad at her. And then she kind of lashes out at them, but then she realizes what she's doing and she releases them. And I feel like the episode should have been more of that and less of a cookie cutter, like four cookie cutter fight scenes don't add up to a dollar or whatever. They kind of missed that emotional beat. I think they could have dragged that out, because that's been the thing that's Wanda's crime, essentially, this whole season, is these innocent people are being hurt by her grief. Right. And so I feel like the balance is a little off in that episode, whereas the balance in Mando, I felt like, you get that long moment of Din and Grogu saying goodbye, and of course he has to take his helmet off, and there's the, you know, all that stuff.
I think the problem is that that they're not a one-to-one comparison, because Wanda has done something wrong. She's done something bad. And Mando hasn't, right? So Wanda essentially is the villain of the whole arc of the season, even though she's not, right? And it was like, it was Agatha all along or whatever.
Was it?
But it wasn't, right? Like, Wanda is the one who has put these people in the prison of their own minds. And the show both wants to tell us that that was a horrific crime, and that these people suffered a lot. But then it also needs us to only be emotionally invested in Wanda saying goodbye to her quote unquote family, in a scene that I found immensely confusing, because they don't, like I said, I was busy thinking about Maggie Nelson and the Argonauts, and queerness and queer families. But it was very unclear to me by the time I came back to myself why they were like putting the kids to bed, and all this stuff. And they just seemed to be sort of waiting around. And to the degree that I was like, what are they waiting for? I don't understand. And then obviously it's for the bubble to collapse. But that is framed as the emotional pinnacle. And you're right, Josh, it shouldn't have been. Cause the emotional pinnacle is really when Wanda, is supposed to face what it is that she's done to all of these people. And of course she refuses that too, right? And it could be really interesting, but instead we get Monica saying they'll never know what you sacrificed for them. She sacrificed, like, you know, three fake people she'd spent 9 days with. Like, I get it, but also, no, it doesn't make up for it, you know?
Oh, I was going to say, as much as I loved Catherine Hahn in that series, Catherine Hahn's amazing. Everything she did in the show was great, but the show would have made more sense and I think would have worked better if there just hadn't been another villain and it just been Wanda did this terrible thing and she has to
Wanda
deal with that.
Villain. Because Wanda's the villain of House of M, right? Like,
yeah, it's not that Agatha's the villain, and maybe they could have done a better job with this. I think really that the whole point is she's just trying to get her powers. And right. She's trying to figure out, how does this woman who like doesn't know how to do spells have all this power? She's trying to take it from her. And she's manipulated her a bit in the same way that Wanda manipulated people. But she is not responsible for the harm that Wanda is doing to those people. And I think they're trying to set it up as like a Thor-Loki situation, right? Because in the comics, Agatha's – she's also Wanda's mentor. She's the one who teaches her magic. I think they're just – again, it's – I'm sure she will show up in Doctor Strange 2 because they're going to have some magic emergency and it's going to be like – I know who we need to get, and it's going to cut to Westfield, and it's going to be Catherine Hahn, you know, whatever, in a headband and like doing crunches or something. And then Wanda's going to release her and it's going to be like, okay, I need to know how to do this spell because Doctor Strange needs to unlock the mystery of whatever.
Well, I think Wanda is set to be the villain of Doctor Strange too.
Oh, you think so?
I do. And I think that, well, I have a whole read on the end. But yeah, also like the punishment for Agatha at the end of it all was to be permanently or in perpetuity for as long as until we need her in another movie, locked in the prison that Wanda just has had to mea culpa. Oops, I locked you all in this prison, right? Like Wanda really, I mean, listen, I'm an abolitionist. What Wanda did at the end is evil.
Yes.
Lazy storytelling, right? It's like, what do we do with the bad guy? We got to put them on ice, you know, until we need them again.
Right.
It's not as creative. Like, it just kind of follows the general formula. Whereas a lot of the show is very creative.
Yeah.
What do you mean it followed a formula? This time the final Skybeam was red and it was made by the good guy. So I think it was very different.
I've been waiting
to make that point.
I want to talk about the action scenes too, but can I just make a point about the sort of the villains of these shows really quickly?
Yeah.
Or raise a question, I guess. Yeah, Eric, I think you're right. I think it's a better show if they just embrace the fact that Wanda is a villain here. Maybe unknowingly, but nonetheless a villain. I love Catherine Hahn's existence in the MCU. If this show does nothing else except get her into future movies, then it will have been a success in my eyes. But I think he or she needs, I think that they needed to be, they thought they needed to be unclear about what was Agatha all along. Like, I think that that, because Josh, you're right. Like that little, sequence, which is masterful and brilliant. And we all talked about it for a week for very good reasons. She wasn't doing the big villainous things of the show. She was creating shenanigans, right? She was like messing with things around the edges a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think her presence gives the show enough leeway to like maybe make viewers forget that it was Wanda all along, right? And I think one of the other things that works better in the Mando finale than this finale, although I'm not as on board with Luke Skywalker's appearance as maybe some of you all. I don't want to relitigate it because Ahsoka made me cry. The presence of Giancarlo Esposito like changes every scene in that finale, because even when he is defeated, he's so confident and like thoughtful and like manipulative that, you know, even though he's like tied up and surrounded by some of the greatest killers in the galaxy, you like know he has another card to play, and it changes how all of those scenes operate. And Catherine Hahn could do that if they let her, but they didn't give her that to do.
Right.
In this episode, she just becomes like another in a long line of Marvel villains who, if they had a mustache, would twirl the mustache. And we're just sitting to wait to see whether the villain or the hero can shoot more powerful CGI beams out of their hands.
Yes. Agree.
Which brings me to a question, which is, why am I so often bored by action scenes in the MCU?
Oh, it's because they've been pre-vised 8 months before it ever filmed, and there's like no sense of discovery, or it's the process of making those action scenes themselves, the very process of it strips any sense of fun or originality out of them, and it's bad.
Okay.
I'm saying like you're not wrong, right?
No. For some reason, I thought it would be a more complicated answer, but that makes perfect sense.
Well, so like you think about, I mean, for me, I think about Winter Soldier. Captain America: Winter Soldier is probably my number one. Actually, I'm going to say it's my number two because Thor: Ragnarok is my number one Marvel movie.
That's fair.
Both very good.
Yeah.
Well, Thor: Ragnarok gets number one because it's like it's like being charged into a bisexual charging station, and you're just like at full bisexual power by the time you finish watching the film. Regardless, the what's so fun and unique and fresh about Winter Soldier, which if you remember is really like, I mean, that's the film that brings the Russo brothers in, and they go on to shepherd sort of the rest of the arc of the Avengers films and the Marvel Cinematic Universe itself, right? So they become kind of like the top guys once they come in, and those fight scenes are not wholly, but to some extent they're different, they're faster paced, and they're more hand-to-hand combat. And it really was like an infusion of freshness after an explosive start with Iron Man, and then a little bit of like a middling sophomore season kind of those films.
And it's the same thing with Mando, right? They have great stunt coordinators. They shot almost everything. Like, they're not just shooting green screen. They're shooting in this thing called the volume, right? Which is basically a dome where they project really high quality images of whatever location they want to be.
And I think it's run inside the Unreal Engine, right? So they're actually literally inside of, it's not like they're just like rear projecting static images. Right, they're inside of like a 3D video game kind of space or interactive space
They can, which is why it looks so good.
Yes.
But they're doing, you know, like, so there's not one, but there's two different Mando stunt doubles, right? So Pedro Pascal, of course, is doing the voice, but you have one guy who does just the martial arts and another guy who does all the gun, like shooting the rifles and the blasters and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they did really, really rigorous again, when you're using lightsabers and stuff, it's hand to hand and it's close up. So they did really like cool stunt work that makes it, the stakes are there. It's more interesting looking. It's not just, oh, one computer drawn vision is flying towards another computer drawn vision flying the other way. And Paul Bettany's just doing voiceover in a booth.
Yeah, I don't know that Elizabeth Olsen doing her weird hand movements is ever going to be as compelling. And that's kind of a fault of the premise or the setup, right? Like, you can't have everyone is doing CG stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Her, Agatha, and the visions. I'm so upset about this, I'm losing my voice.
As opposed to Ahsoka, right, where they like built her physical lightsabers that light up, and they worked super hard for them to look a certain way and to move a certain way and to have a certain shape, as opposed to just these hand gestures, which are then you're in post, you're just throwing red light on afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and I mean, we ragged on Age of Ultron earlier for lots of good reasons, but one of the sequences that I like is it later in that first opening sequence where Wanda shows up and she's a villain and she like, she doesn't fight them. She like tricks them, right? She gives them visions that will, right?
And yeah, like, she like hypnotizes them kind of.
Right. Like what an interesting thing. What an interesting thing to add to this. Like, right. At this point we've seen these heroes like fight back an alien invasion and stuff. But now what if someone can just like
activate
change
their
what
trauma.
They see? Right. Yeah. Like what? Yeah. What if someone can just like trigger those kinds of, And then they just like by the end of the movie, that is no longer happening. Right. It's go ahead.
No, finish your thought.
No, I just, it's almost like the creative team like decided that was too scary to imagine or something.
So one thing that's interesting about Age of Ultron, basically, it's three movies in one, and obviously, as we have mentioned, it has some narrative problems, but thematically, it 100% sets up everything in Infinity War and Endgame. All of the pieces are there in terms of, you know, Wanda basically catalyzes Tony's fears and all this stuff, and anyway, so there's actually a lot of important MCU stuff there, unfortunately not in the best vessel, which is Ultron himself's problem, that he can't find the right vessel for his powerful ideas. So maybe it's a really appropriate that it's a metaphor for the whole MCU. But yeah, just to say that Wanda's ultimate power, the way they set it up there, is not shooting beams. It's that she actually can activate guilt and fear and confusion. And that's what tears apart the Avengers and forces them to go have lunch at Hawkeye's house and meet his secret family, which is the best part of the movie. When they're
no, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I don't remember any of this.
I did not want to be involved in Joss Whedon's marriage in the way that I was made to be involved in it, watching that scene. Didn't like it then, don't like it now.
There's a thing earlier, and this is a minor point that we should cut, but since we're talking about Hawkeye's marriage, Scarlett Johansson's character wears a necklace with a arrow pendant to signify her connection to Hawkeye.
Mm-hmm.
And then like three films later, we realize that he is married and has multiple children.
Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
The problem is that Joss Whedon needed her, the scarred and broken female, to fuck the Hulk.
Right.
And so that anything that was going to build with Hawkeye had to be subsumed to Joss Whedon's obsession with broken girls who find great strength within themselves that is born out of their trauma and then love the monster,
and
which is him,
calm,
by the way.
Calm monstrous men. Yeah. Fair.
Yes, everyone in that movie is convinced that they're a monster. There's a lot of monstrosity talk thrown around.
Well, Natasha can't have children, so she must be a monster.
Yeah,
that right. If you don't have the uterus, you become a fucking
monster.
That is
for sure.
So.
That is for sure the nadir of perhaps all MCU dialogue.
Oh my god.
Oh, it's so upsetting. We have to end on a better note than that.
Well, do we want to zoom out and think about what's coming down the pike and the sort of the way these two shows have launched the kind of Disney Plus model of like new shows that we're going to see?
Sure. I also like Corey's pitch for like, or, you know, pitch a show set in one of these universes. I like that a lot too.
We could.
Do you have one?
If you all want to talk about it for an episode, I think we could talk about like the streaming wars for an episode. If we want to hold that,
we can
and
talk
do
about
that.
Anything for an episode.
Well, fair enough. But right, we could do that, and we could just do quick Disney Plus pitches now.
Yeah. Well, I do have like a wrap up thought. Which is that if we to like zoom out just really briefly on, you know, Disney and Disney Plus as the kind of home of these shows that are doing new and maybe interesting things, sometimes less interesting things in their respective, like we need a new, like a word for like a mega franchise now, because these are bigger than, just other tentpole franchises. Worth remembering, of course, that, Disney really clearly and specifically, when coronavirus closed down a lot of the state's economies here in the U.S., Disney really specifically said, like, we're going to pivot to online content providing, like, that the online stuff was going to be kind of their bread and butter moving forward. They were going to pour all their resources into that. Because obviously, like, in a world with climate change and global pandemics and all of these things that are ramping up, like, running cruise ships and theme parks is not necessarily, like, a bulletproof business model anymore. So I think what we're going to see is a lot more of these kinds of shows appearing on Disney Plus, and I think we're going to probably long term see a lot fewer tentpole franchise films going to theaters. I think Disney is really a good what's the word, weather vane? I don't know. They're a good sort of flag to see which way the wind is blowing. And the wind is blowing away from, like, I don't want to go sit in a movie theater for the next probably 2 years. So we're going to see more of this stuff. Go ahead.
And no, just even the feature films that were in the pipeline before coronavirus, right? The only ones that they haven't dumped onto streaming are the MCU ones, right? Like, that's the only property that they seem to think is too big for Disney Plus, right? We've had two Pixar movies on Disney Plus. We had the live action Mulan remake, and now we have a new Disney animated film just like last week, right? Dropped onto Disney Plus. So yeah, it's only Black Widow that they're holding on to.
Right. And we know what the new slate of Star Wars shows like are going to be, right? And whether or not we end up getting all of them or whatever, but we're certainly going to get the Book of Boba Fett. We're certainly going to get the Ahsoka show. And there's another one. Is it the Bad Batch?
The Bad Batch.
I'm less convinced that Rangers of the New Republic is going to come out, or at least going to come out in the foreseeable future them, you know, summarily firing Gina Carano at some point.
Correct. But in any case, it's looking like every Friday for the next foreseeable future, we'll have new Star Wars or Marvel content.
True. Oh, fuck. I cannot wait. Oh, I cannot wait for Winter Soldier and the Falcon. Holy cow. I'm so excited.
You don't have long to wait. It's like
Friday. I know.
It's next Friday.
Next Friday.
That's actually the one that I'm least excited about. No, that's not true. I'm least excited about Hawkeye, as is right.
No. I think the Hawkeye is going to be really cool, though, because it's going to be about Kate Bishop Hawkeye. If that Matt Fraction run is actually, like, super good, and I wish that the Marvel Cinematic Universe Hawkeye was more like Matt Fraction's Hawkeye from that run. But Kate Bishop is the jam, and also... Okay. here we go. I'll give you my pitch for our concluding segment. If we could pitch a show in one of these mega franchise universes, I believe that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is setting us up somewhere, however far down the line, for a Young Avengers. And I want that show so badly. And I want it to be Skins, the British show Skins, ooh, but with Young Avengers. Because we've now met Billy and Tommy, you know, Wanda's kids, yes, who are members of the Young Avengers. And we're going to meet Kate Bishop. And we've met Cassie Lang, who is, Ant-Man's daughter, mm-hmm, and because of the snap is now like 18 or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's what I want. I want like a Euphoria-esque show, with teen superheroes.
So like a New Mutants, but good.
Somewhere between New Mutants and that Runaways show that was just ponderously long.
yeah, that's
but I fair. Want, I mean, I want like, do they have superpowers? Yes. But is the show really about them like doing drugs and fucking and going to Coachella? Yes. That's what I want.
I want to greenlight that. I want to hire you to run that show right now. That sounds fantastic.
Alan Heinberg can do it. Like, he literally came from television, and he's the one who wrote The Young Avengers. Blanket, thank it, it's ready to go.
That's fantastic. I want it. That sounds great. Eric and Josh, do you have a pitch?
Yeah. I don't know. I think something along the lines of... like, I just like things that are ground level that have no connection to the larger universe or tenuous connection to the larger universe. Like, when I was mm-hmm. a kid, I liked imagining myself as that random rebel soldier in the background, or I piloted the Y-Wing that survived the Battle of Yavin. So, like, just have a random show about people in the Star Wars universe. No Skywalkers. Maybe no lightsabers. I'd be fine with that. Just like grunts living in Star Wars.
What if we could do a show that was just the teen? It was young Indiana Jones, but with what's his ethnic hips? Oscar Isaac's character, Poe Dameron.
Yeah.
Like young Indiana Jones, but with Poe Dameron.
Well, yeah. Poe Dameron's busy being Moon Knight.
True, true. Oh. Also, well, bringing up Poe Dameron reminded me of my actual pitch, a love story with Finn and Poe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's yes. go into the future when it's revealed that Zori Bliss was just a beard and go from there.
We are getting a Cassian Andor show, supposedly, which might have some of that young indie energy.
I'm excited about that.
I need young Latinos in space.
Yeah. Yeah. Josh, do you have a pitch? I'm delaying not because I have a great ending, but because I'm formulating one as we speak.
I will go the exact opposite way and say I really do want to see a Luke Skywalker show, whether it's with this crazy CGI de-aging or whether it's just animated to like make it simpler. I like a lot of the stuff that's coming down the pike. I'm really excited that they're going to do an Ironheart show, which is Riri Williams. So like black girl at MIT builds her own version of the Iron Man suit. Eve Ewing has a really good run in the comics about mm-hmm. that character. I'm really excited for the Ahsoka stuff and the Obi-Wan stuff. As far as on the MCU side, at some point we're going to have to see the X-Men, and I hope so. They just rebooted the X-Men in the comics with Jonathan Hickman, and there's some really, really cool stuff. And I hope that they kind of use that as a model. Basically, like all the mutants start their own nation on this mutant island, and they find a way to like not exactly resurrect themselves, but they can like build new bodies and download their consciousness, which Xavier stores in Cerebro. And it's all very like sci-fi and weird. And all of Hickman's stories always had these massive scopes and they kind of like build and expand. And some of the sword stuff that was referenced in WandaVision and also at the end of the second Spider-Man movie. You know, Nick Fury right now is in space, like building space stations for S.W.O.R.D. Some of that stuff gets to some Hickman Avengers comics that are also really cool. And I just hope they use that as the touchstone, because his stuff is all like really weird and complicated, and the scale of it is really interesting. So I don't know if we're going to see, I don't know what form we're going to see the X-Men, but now that Disney has the property, I mean, I assume there will be Disney Plus X-Men shows to build out those characters mm-hmm. before we see them in theaters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do y'all want to see existing X-Men universe actors come over, or do you want a clean slate on that? Because we thought we were getting the X-Men cinematic universe version of Pietro, but then that was stunt casting.
I did love that stunt casting.
No, I deeply did not understand the resolution of that storyline. underwritten to a degree that really bothered me.
He was just a dude. He was just a dude. But
he was a dude who had a headshot. So he was an actor who lived in New Jersey in like some weird man cave. But then the rest of his house was really big. Like, what?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe he was.
I don't really care. I think they needed a clean slate, to be honest.
I agree. I actually like that character and that performance in those X-Men movies, which are kind of hit or miss to be kind.
Generous.
I think he's fun in those movies. But I was, yeah, like what it possibly signified gave me pause. So I guess my one pitch would be all new X-Men cast. I guess if they want to keep making Deadpool movies, they can, but I will not be joining them. sorry. I'm with Eric. I like the idea of like ground level stuff, either divorced from or commenting on or responding to. Like, I like one of my favorite things in the MCU is that first Spider-Man movie where Michael Keaton is like the mm-hmm. villain is this normal guy who's made his living off of like collecting the scrap from these like giant otherworldly fights happening above them day to day. And mm-hmm. I would love to sit with and think more about like, now that I'm saying it, maybe I don't, but like what would it be like to just be a normal human being confronted by these like massive threats seemingly every couple of months, right? Like the timeline of these 20 something movies is not very, it seems like every couple of months there is some new threat from somewhere. And what does a college look like in this world, right? What does the office in the Marvel universe look like? I guess that would be my pitch, and I would watch it, and maybe Eric would watch it, and no one else.
I'd watch it. I'd give it a first episode look.
Yeah, let's get Jim from the office on the phone and tell him he doesn't want to be Mr. Fantastic. He wants to just reprise his role in Scranton in the MCU. That's my
pick.
Oh
man, you know what's really weird about that is that it completely works because Randall Park is Asian Jim.
Oh.
Do you guys remember? Do you remember that cold open with Asian Jim?
Yes. Yeah.
Great. Just us.
No, I feel like we're like two Twitter threads away from like a fan theory that goes semi-viral.
Yeah. Apparently, this we could cut this, but apparently, Randall Park did. I mean, he was on set for like an afternoon for that Asian Jim thing, mm-hmm. And then a long time later, he was just like out in LA somewhere, and this guy was like, "Hey, Asian Jim!" And Randall Park thought he was like the subject of like racist harassment, and he was like,
"Oh my god,
the fuck is like what is the Jim? I don't understand the part of this." And then more and more people like, "What does that mean?" Right? More and more people started calling him Asian Jim, and then he was like, he had to like really consciously reach back and be like, "Oh, right, that afternoon I did on that show The Office."
That is, yeah, because 500 times more people have watched that show in the last 5 years than ever watched it in its initial run, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Like, it's had this afterlife that is unbelievable. Yeah.
Do you think any of these Marvel or Star Wars shows will have that kind of afterlife?
While watching one of the episodes of WandaVision, I looked at Katie and said, who's going to watch this in 10 years? And she looked at me and said, we watched A New Hope like a month ago. So probably yes.
Okay.
Well, imagine if you were 14 and you watched The Mandalorian. I mean,
right.
It's going to be the same thing. You'll probably watch it every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the prequels imprinted on kids, right? And these are better than those were.
Oh, yeah. Very true.
Do we have other thoughts, or should we close what's the name of the book? Shit. What's the book she's reading?
The Darkhold.
Thank you. Should we close the Darkhold on this episode?
Oh, I want to tell you.
I want your reading. I want your reading of this.
Okay, so here's my pitch for Doctor Strange 2, which we know is called The Multiverse of Madness.
Right.
I think that Wanda is searching for multiverse versions of Billy and Tommy. And what she does is going to end up kind of like ripping apart the walls between the multiverses in a way that's really problematic. And Doctor Strange is going to have to. Yeah. Doctor Strange is going to have to like correct whatever it is that she, the havoc that she wreaks on this. Cause she's a chaos agent now.
Right? Yeah. I'd watch that.
Can we get some like Lovecraftian horrors that come in through the multiverse?
I mean, so Multiverse of Madness in itself is like a reference to In the Mouth of Madness, right?
Which is that like my question? Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
And who is? Is it Raimi who's directing it now?
It is. Yeah.
Oh, there it
is. I think it's going to be like in, you know, still conforming to the Marvel House style, but I do think we're going to get some like psychedelic plus Lovecraftian. The real question is like, can we get Sam Neill to reprise his role from In the Mouth of Madness? We've got Taika, right? Like doing Thor 4.
Do you think that they will have the guts to let Wanda own her villainy, or will it be the same kind of like, oh sorry, my bad, that they did at the end of WandaVision? I want her as a villain. Like I want her as just like an out and out like, yeah, I wanted to save my kids.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
I do think she's going to be like the big bad, to borrow a term that Joss Whedon gave to us. Just like Wanda. He gave her to us. Yeah, I think so. But then again, you know, I don't have any special insight into the Marvel creative process, so who fucking knows? Nice.
I think she will be the villain, or I think that's plausible. I don't think she will be unredeemed at the end, though. I think she will. There will be a return to sanity, even if it's in another movie. Like it very well might end with things in chaos, and that would probably be a smart way to end it.
Right.
To give a lot of anticipation, but I do think ultimately she will be like brought back into the fold. That's just the nature of these MCU stories. None of these Avengers can ultimately be bad. They can only have dark sides that they triumph over.
To bring a third franchise into our conversation, I think it's going to be a Fast and Furious model where she's the villain and then she joins the family and drinks Coronas with everyone in the next
movie.
And
then they street race as like, and then freeze framed as the credits roll. Yeah. Okay.
I'm for it. Actually, where is my Fast and Furious part of the Marvel universe? Or the Star Wars universe. They could be speeders.
Like a pod racing show.
Now that's what I call pod racing. Speeder bike racing.
I love it. Yes. Pod racing.
Actually, well, you say that, but there is a little watched animated show called Resistance that's about It's on Disney Plus. It's like two seasons. It takes place before Force Awakens. Poe Dameron is in it. Oscar Isaac did the voiceover, but it's mainly about a kid whose like father is like someone important in the New Republic, and he becomes a spy. And it, a lot of it is, it takes place on this like isolated station, and it's all about the racers, and it's very much your like ground level thing, Eric. It's like,
oh, I watched Resistance.
Oh, you watched Resistance. Okay. Yeah, like he's got to get the parts to repair the ship, but to get the parts, he's got to do this errand, but he screwed it up because he alienated this guy who's trying to kill him, and it's a lot of hijinks, and yeah.
Can I tell you guys a fun fact about that show?
Of course.
Sure. Yes.
The star is voiced by and animated to look like an actor named Christopher Sean, and he was our Bingley in the Lizzie Bennet Diaries. And of course he's Asian, so he was Bing Lee.
Oh, nice.
in our updated version. But yeah, Chris is a super nice guy. He's like one of the nicest actors I've ever met. And I think he's going to appear in a live action thing because his character is animated to look exactly like him.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's super cool.
Just a little insider info.
You'll be 1 degree from Star Wars.
Breaking news.
Oh,
I guess you already are. You'll be 1 degree from live action Star Wars if that happens. Well,
right. Should we do like a little wrap up?
Yeah.
Let's do
like
it.
A goodbye.
Yeah. Yes. Well, thanks everybody for talking through this. And I'm really shitty at this. Somebody else save me. My brain is broken.
Talk in the plus.
In
the plus.
There you go.
Yeah. Sorry for, I feel like shouting at you all about Star Wars.
Well, Eric, as you can tell, none of us have any opinions about Star Wars, and we were very off.
No.
I was worried singing. I was very loud.
To paraphrase another property that is now owned by Disney, The Simpsons, I for one welcome our new content overlords.
On that note, bye you guys.
Bye everybody.
Bye.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Molly's Minute Rant, which is apparently a new segment that we're doing. I have not watched many Marvel movies or many superhero movies in general, but I have strong feelings about them. And those feelings are primarily that the Marvel movies are neoliberal hero worship that are stupid. Instead of investing strong communities or doing organization building work, we invest one person to solve with the power and the hopes to solve all of our problems. No, thank you. In addition, they are military propaganda. This isn't even some nutso conspiracy theory. This is literally true. The military literally invests in the superhero movies in order to, like, you know, promote ideas of American greatness and imperialism. So I think they're dumb. And that's why I'm not on this episode. And apparently my new role is just to talk about things that I hate. So with that in mind, please enjoy this episode of Technically Pop. Have a good one, everybody.